This is Fresh Ed, a weekly podcast that makes complex ideas in educational research easily understood. I'm your host, Will Brehm. Today, we put the field of comparative and international education in conversation with film studies. With me is Irv Epstein, Emeritus Professor in Peace and Justice at Illinois Wesleyan University.
The principles of affect theory that I have emphasized include things such as interconnection, meaning-making, assemblage, and contingency. And I think you find that when you look at film and when you look also at comparative education research, that those principles are quite useful and quite important.
Irv Epstein's new book is Education, Affect, and Film: Visual Imaginings and Global Explorations Through a Comparative Lens. Irv Epstein, welcome back to Fresh Ed.
Glad to be here, Will.
So congratulations on your new book. I really enjoyed reading it. It's challenging because you're taking two fields, comparative education and maybe something called film studies, and sort of putting them together and weaving in some of your ideas that you've previously written about on affect, which I've interviewed you about 4 years ago on that topic specifically. So it's really nice to see you sort of pushing some of these boundaries. And you write something at the end of your book. You say, quote, CIE, Comparative and International Education, when done well, embraces the search for new ideas to be found in environments distinct from those for which one is most comfortable. Were you searching for new ideas by bringing together these two sort of different fields together, and in particular connecting it to your ongoing work on affect?
Well, yes, I wanted to extend the work on affect. I had previously done some work on film and had written about street children in film, as well as a few films on Chinese education, Cultural Revolution, Post-Cultural Revolution films. And thematically, those were interesting, but it didn't go deep enough. And what happened was that I discovered that Gilles Deleuze had written this two-volume study of cinema. And of course, he was a key affect theoretician whom I read previously. So it seemed to me to make some sense to explore this area. It's a way of making, I think, affect theory a little bit more accessible, as well as expanding our notion of comparison and of comparative education.
It's quite a feat, right? I mean, Deleuze is, of course, notoriously difficult to get your head into. And a two-volume book on cinema must have been just sort of eye-opening. I mean, was it hard to get through that?
Yeah, one reads commentaries about the work, and then one goes through and picks and chooses. And with all of these theoreticians, you know, there's the danger of being quite superficial and not really appreciating context. On the other hand, there's something which is enjoyable about applying something to a new situation and thinking of it in new ways. So I hope that I haven't been too destructive of these ideas and superficially recounting them, but I do so, I think, hopefully for a noble purpose.
And what would you say that noble purpose is?
It's to, first of all, introduce a comparative education audience to some of these ideas. And second of all, to basically say what we do as comparative educators has ramifications in all sorts of fields, and we're not alone, that the issues we struggle with because of our innate humanity and humanness, if that's a word, that's compelling, and it's compelling to see that in many different ways.
So what would you say some of those big issues are that are both found in film studies and in comparative and international education?
There's a basic question of representation, of what is real, what are we depicting? And there's a question of audience as to who we are writing for and how we treat our subjects. There are all sorts of questions about assumptions with regard to how we act, with regard to determinism and agency. And then if you want to be a little bit more granular, there's similarities and similar patterns with regard to the way in which the fields have developed as disciplines, and some theoretical issues. So to give a couple of examples, theoretically, when you look at the history of comparative international education, at one point, there is a focus on the founding fathers. And in film theory, auteur theory really looks at the unique styles of directors as individuals. At different points, at different times, those fixations become a bit passé as people move on. In comparative and international education, certainly post-World War II, the emphasis upon structuralism through structural functionalism, human capital theory, modernization theory is quite pronounced as international development becomes quite essential to the field. And in film studies and in film theory, so there's structuralism with regard to the notion of language and text, and also structuralism with regard later to psychoanalysis and Marxist views of the film as apparatus. So you see connections there, and then you see connections in terms of the disciplines themselves. They're applied disciplines. They're popular, and yet the academy sort of grudgingly accepts them at different times. They're both very much influenced by the global north. English as a lingua franca in terms of publication can be compared to the necessity of international films having English subtitles. And so the power of the global north audience is there. And then there's a neoliberalism with regard to neoliberal values with regard to things such as competition for publication or competition for juried exhibition and dissemination. So I find all of those things to be quite interesting. I mentioned in the book, it struck me as being quite interesting that Lewis Terman's book on IQ, which promoted eugenics as a rationale for giving IQ tests, was written 1 year after Birth of a Nation, the notorious U.S. film depicting the work in positive terms of the Ku Klux Klan, was published came out. In the same way, in comparative education, in 1934, the main comparative education journal, the International Education Review, was taken over by a Nazi scholar. 1 year later, Triumph of the Will is released. So there's a way in which ideas circulate in different fields. And part of what affect is looking at interconnection. And so the power of ideas is what's really, really useful and significant. And I think, hopefully, we take a look at that through looking at these two supposedly divergent fields with things that they have in common.
I love it because it's like these two fields, which on the surface are so different. And yet, as you've just sort of shown so clearly, is that they've sort of run in parallel and moved up and down with the times, right? Reflecting different dominant ideas. And yet, perhaps, you know, those in the field are just so blinkered to focus on our field alone. And it's hard to make those connections elsewhere to then see if there's any fruitful creation that can come out of bringing these two fields together. So can you tell me a little bit more about how by bringing these together, affect and affect theory becomes sort of really important as a way of understanding the interconnections and the way in which film and education sort of manipulate our senses and our sensibilities?
I guess what I would say is affect, the principles of affect theory that I have emphasized include things such as interconnection, meaning-making, assemblage, and contingency. And I think you find that when you look at film and when you look also at comparative education research, that those principles are quite useful, quite important. I'm not sure in terms of the issues of manipulation, there's discussion about that, right? So there are many who argue, for instance, that it's wrong to simply see film as a way in which your emotions are manipulated according to the director's intent. Modern film theorists are saying, you know, we sort of understand that what we're seeing, the camera, what it is showing, is a bit different from what we actually see. Whether it be the track shot or the close-up, if somebody's running, we see them from the front and then from the back. There's an omniscience there that we know that the camera is acting in a certain way that's not us. At the same time, in comparative education, we know what propaganda is. We know when we suspend our critical thinking or are asked to do that. So I think that affect theory is useful in the sense of asking us to see what kind of connections we make, how vibrant they are, when they dissolve and fall apart. And most importantly, that specifically with respect to film, there's a tolerance of contingency and ambiguity that is not always there with within the education realm. And I think that's quite important. The reason why film can be more authentic rather than the scholarly piece written in academic jargon, in part, is because there aren't solutions. There's no closure, and that's life.
I mean, I'm totally sold on this idea. I love it. As someone who watches a lot of films, I think it's really great to see these connections with my own field. And I'm just so happy that someone has actually taken the time and the energy to go and do this. And I sort of, as I was reading the book, I kept thinking about Slavoj Žižek, who also does a lot of work on film as a philosopher. And he has these, like, there's some YouTube video of him where he's green screened himself in front of different clips of movies. And he points out how ideology is sort of working within the scenes. And I sort of saw you in the same sort of vein where you're sort of taking some of these cases and, you know, you're unpacking the movie and bringing in different sort of film theory and CIE theory to highlight some of these different issues. And I just had such a good time sort of going through it. So if you don't mind, I'd love to maybe unpack two examples from the book just to give the audience a little taste of, you know, what you were trying to do and how you were bringing together these two very different fields. So one of the movies that you really get into is South Korean movie called Parasite, which has been, I think it won an Academy Award. It's won all sorts of awards. Can you tell me a little bit about, you know, Parasite and how you read it in relation to comparative education and film theory?
So Parasite, not only won, it first international film to win Best Picture of the Year. So that was something in the United States, that was something which was quite remarkable. What I loved about the film is that its authenticity is in that it appeals to all of our senses. And to me, it is a radical critique of class and class injustice. But it appeals to our sense of humor and absurdity, as well as the violence of class injustice, which isn't really present when we think of class conflict, specifically in the United States and in academic literature, because we think of meritocracy, generally we buy into it, or we see, well, they're winners or losers, and we see the end result, but we don't see how it affects who we are. We don't see it in identity terms. And in this case, the beauty of the film is that the director uses all of our appeals to all of our senses to see the ways in which class injustice occurs. So a marker for class injustice in this film is smell. A marker is also space. So vertical space represents affluence. The poor are subterranean. They're living in basements. They're stuck. They're not going to move up, right? And that sense of verticality, that is intentional. You know, so when we think of meritocracy, we sort of buy into it, but we don't really see the injustice of it. Now, when we think of comparative international education, at least in the global north versions of, oh, Korean education or South Korean education, we might talk about shadow education, whether it works or whether it doesn't work. We might look at the PISA studies and look how well the Korean students are doing on international assessments. But it does not get to how people see themselves and how education is implicated as being hypocritical and as being injurious. So that's why I think this is a really great film. Now, what I want to say also, you know, in the book, I used three films per theme. So the other two films looking at social class, one is called A Separation, which looks at the Iranian case with regard to these issues of modernity and religion and class, the view that neither solution is ethical. And all of the people, the characters are ethically compromised, and that there seems to be no way out there. And then the third film that I look at with regard to social class is Still Life, which is a great Chinese film by Jia Zhuangke. And in that film, the issues of globalization and alienation resulting from the destruction of this 1,000-year-old city due to the Three Gorges Dam project, you know, what that shows is that there isn't class resistance. And education plays a very minor role in these people trying to confront a changing reality, which has destroyed family life and community. So altogether, these films, although they don't explicitly talk about institutional education. They critique education in terms of its role in confronting class conflict.
And I guess one of the things that comes up is this question of when you read the films and analyze them in this way and try and get an understanding of the machinations of social class and how it works and how it smells and how it looks and how it feels. You know, class is something that scholars, comparative ed scholars, have written about for a long time as well. So is there sort of a difference in what you can do with film when it comes to understanding and representing, you know, an authentic understanding of class compared to sort of the written form when scholars have tried to identify and understand and, you know, represent what social class is or is not?
I think there's a conceptual difference, right? The conceptual difference within the social science literature and the comparative ed literature is much more narrow and limited. So it's often focused upon institutional mechanisms that reproduce class position, or else it's looking at the role of the school as an agent of the state in producing the knowledge economy or in socializing students in certain ways to adhere to certain values or principles. And yet a larger notion of class in terms of identity, in terms of personhood, in terms of your day-to-day existence is something that is often lost. And that's what I think these films help us to appreciate in ways that the formal academic literature doesn't. The other thing I want to say, Will, is that part of the issue is that we are all beneficiaries of the education system. We're the winners. So it's harder for us, even if we critique the system, to come to terms with the possibility that it may be less consequential than we would like us to believe. And I think filmmakers yes. can put us in our place that way.
And I think that's actually, it's humbling and just very healthy, I think, to recognize one's own limitations and limits. Another big topic or theme that you address in the book is race and colonialism, which of course in the field of comparative education has really, like many other academic fields, I would imagine, has really come about in the last few years, or maybe even last decade at this point. And one of the movies, or sort of short collection of movies, series of movies, was something called Small Axe by the sort of artist Steve McQueen. I absolutely loved watching all of these short films. I think Steve McQueen is just absolutely amazing director. And this sort of series of films is about an Afro-Caribbean communities in the UK, and sort of issues of identity, issues of racism really come out. And he does it in these absolutely beautiful films. So how do you read Small Axe when it comes to film theory and comparative education? Like, how do you understand race and colonialism by watching Steve McQueen's Small Axe films?
So what I do is I present basically three themes with regard to the academic literature on race. Within the United States, Afro-pessimism is quite prominent, and it's the feeling that it's not enough to think of race in terms of racial capitalism or simply as an affectation of global capitalism or empire building. It's something more fundamental. And then there's also work on whiteness as the default, as you know, and it being predominant throughout cultural. And then with Small Axe, I think that represents the third kind of view. And it's interesting that the writer who's really pioneered work in terms of the Black diaspora, Paul Gilroy, was a consultant on these films. And so the notion of Black diaspora is a sense of possibility, of the fact that you are not, your indigeneity is not limited to physical space. And the idea is that, yes, as Afro-Caribbeans, we are part of the empire. The empire, the British Empire, is not whiteness per se. And we can negotiate a way of really creating something important and relevant. And the struggles of this community to manage and balance their own sense of identity, which on the one hand, when they are not allowed to affirm it publicly in public spaces, is something which occurs throughout. But it's quite positive, with the exception of Lover's Rock, which was your favorite and my favorite too, because of its ambiguity. But in all of these films, they're heroes at the end. They persevere. So they're able to manipulate the systems. And it's the education system and education, the final film, as well as the legal system, the police system. And so there's a heroism which is there. But that's totally antithetical to the comparative work, the Underground Railroad series, which I look at, which affirms Afro-pessimism as racism being enduring and permanent, a permanent sting on American character, as well as the South African film Tsotsi, which really unintentionally affirms whiteness and white purity and sees blackness really as threatening. So yeah, that's how I would see that, how that works out.
In terms of Lover's Rock, I mean, I think one of the reasons I love that, there's that long scene of the dance party where the music is going and it seems to be like one continuous shot. And it moves around and you just see this whole world. It was exciting, right? And it felt like I was there. And when I watched that, it had such an effect on me, and it created an emotion where I felt like I was part of that dance party. And I just, you know, it is truly something that I don't, like, only film can do that, right? Film can bring you into this world, and just, it was amazing. I don't know how Steve McQueen did that shot, but it was just, because it was quite a long shot, if I recall. And it was just this amazing, amazing scene that I absolutely loved about Lover's Rock.
But for me, it's juxtaposed with the question of masculinity. And then at the very end, the tragic nature of being, you know, a main character just being dehumanized. And that's the reality. So it's this temporary escape, which doesn't last. But what he does and what you're mentioning, you know, it's not just the visual in film. It's really looking at all of the senses. Food is very important, a cultural artifact in these films, as well as space, movement, touch, you know. So it's not simply the visual.
And in their collection, it's engrossing. And as I think you rightly bring up, is that it is juxtaposed these certain sort of exciting feelings with absolute feelings of horror and dread. And he does it so well because he sort of moves through them almost seamlessly. And you're on this roller coaster of emotions watching that particular short film. You know, Irv, when I read your book, at some point, maybe it's in the acknowledgments, you sort of talk about how this is a book that you sort of came up with and really, or started really working on during COVID. And it was like the perfect COVID project in a way, right? Because you can just watch films and you can be in your head. You don't have to go out into the world of, you know, field work. And as I was reading it, it then made me, when I was reading about Steve McQueen's Small Axe, it made me think about his newer film called Occupied City, which was his sort of COVID project, right? Where he went around Amsterdam filming all these different sites and then juxtaposing the sites that he filmed with sort of archival material about who lived in those places during the Nazi occupation. And I'd love to just, you know, what did you think of that film? I know it's not in your book, but it's the same director, and it happened at the same time that you put this book together.
So I think it was his wife, right, who is from Amsterdam, who did the book documenting and mapping Holocaust atrocities repeatedly in Amsterdam. And in fact, the context is that very little in this society has been done to reconcile the collaboration and actually what happened. What I found fascinating about the film was that the text becomes more important than the imagery. That the imagery we see in terms of the day-to-day functioning, right, the lack of historical memory and the lack of coming to terms with what's happened. And in repeating that, then your focus becomes on the text rather than the image. And I think that's an interesting inversion of what one normally expects. So it was very difficult to watch it 4 hours. So I had to watch it in two different time periods. But I thought it was, and part of it, a lot of it is quite repetitive, right? And it starts out, you know, looking at a particular space, explaining what's happened, and then the common is destroyed, right? And you see that throughout. So I found it to be quite interesting and quite an interesting inversion of what one would normally expect.
I totally agree. I couldn't watch it all in one go either. It was relentless. It was monotonous. It was repetitive. And you just sort of, it lulled you in. And I think you're right. The text became much more important. There were certain moments that I thought worked really well, the text and what was being seen, and it was just sort of disturbing, right, to watch. Really jarring. And then other parts of it were sort of, well, I guess ambiguous, and it sat with me. I was a bit more unsettled in the sense of I wasn't sure if he was sort of saying the COVID lockdowns are akin to the Nazi occupation, because at some points it sort of went down that road and I'm like, wait a second. And it sort of really threw me off as well.
I think there were some people who were protesting and were doing that. But at the end, when you saw all the freedom that they had and what was happening, then you saw that that was quite ridiculous. To me, what was most jarring were the scenes in apartments where people eating, cleaning, living in these horrific spaces where such violence occurred. And it brought me back. I've been to Dachau and I've been to Ravenswood, the concentration camps. And it's impossible to fully understand the horror of what's happened there. When I was in Ravenswood a few years ago, they had kids coming and they were playing soccer on the site. And that's a similar feeling, right? Of, yes, life goes on, but how do you honor the memory of those who suffered and who died? And what is memory other than an extension of the present? So, I mean, those are interesting questions, which I think he raises.
I love it. And just how it, and geography is so, you know, important to how memory works or doesn't work. It was a fascinating film. I've heard very mixed reviews about it, but I would recommend it because it was definitely an experience. I want to return back to the main topic here and, you know, just sort of ask you, now that you've looked at all these films, you've sort of really done a deep dive into film theory, connecting it to comparative education. What's your overall read on how films or what films can tell us about sort of education more broadly?
I might be, you know, repeating myself a bit, but what I think that films tell us, they reiterate the point that education involves interconnection. It is, and that is essentially what we, in fact, are about. And we don't have the answers as to why we connect and interconnect. And at the same time, films tell us, I think, that life is not predictable and life is quite uncertain. I've moved a recent book by a political scientist, Brian Klass, called Fluke. And he talks about the importance of random events in life. So to give you an example, he mentions the fact that Henry Stimson, the Secretary of War, 25 years before the dropping of the bomb, visited Kyoto and fell in love with Kyoto with his wife. That's why Kyoto was not bombed and Hiroshima was. So who can predict that? As a result, he says, what that means is that every moment is precious, that every event has meaning. And I think that's something that we can take out through these films, right? Mm-hmm. That we can appreciate life without resolving the questions that these films raise. And in terms of educational issues and comparative education, there can be a little less hubris as to what we do, a little more modesty. And it's important to look for patterns and to look for things that are similarities. And we need structure in our lives, but we don't need to overdo it, right? And I think that the more we think of comparative education, particularly as one of many different fields open to ideas from different areas, and in Klaus's case, it's chaos theory, which moves him, the more we can expand the field. And I think that's something that's worth pursuing.
Well, Irv Epstein, thank you so much for joining Fresh Ed again. It's absolutely always a pleasure to talk with you, and I look forward to your next book.
Thank you, Will.
Irv Epstein is Emeritus Professor at Illinois Wesleyan University. His new book is entitled Education, Affect, and Film. Please note that opinions expressed on Fresh Ed are solely those of the host or the guest interviewed, not Fresh Ed, which takes no institutional position. If you've liked what you've heard today, please rate us wherever you listen to podcasts. Reviews really do help. Fresh Ed's team includes Fatih Aktaş, Obafemi Ogunle, Phyllis Che Mensah, Jose Neto, and Sabrina Matiri. Original music for Fresh Ed was created by Digital Primate. Fresh Ed is an independently run podcast without advertisements and is made possible by the support of NORAG, the ShockDev Family Fund, and listeners like you. Please consider donating to Fresh Ed by visiting freshedpodcast.com/donate. Thanks for listening. I'm Will Brehm, and I'll be back next week.